And also want to credit my colleagues, Jimmy Dills and Beth Fuller, who worked on this project with me. And so I'm going to be presenting a health impact assessment that we did on Georgia's qualified allocation plan for how the state allocates low-income housing tax credits. This was their 2015 plan. And I have no disclosures or no financial relationships. Also want to credit the Health Impact Project, which is a collaborative of the Pew Charitable Trust, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for supporting this work. And I have been really excited to see at this conference, I mean, just to see an entire conference dedicated to health and all policies. This is something that is kind of old hat to me. I've been working in it for a long time. And I keep hearing people saying, you know, we want to address health and all policies. We want to bring the sectors together. How do we do it? And you know, I'm really kind of excited about that because I think we have a way to do that. Health impact assessment is sort of it's not always the right tool. They're not always successful, but they frequently are, and they're sort of the wedge that creates that you use first in order to start those relationships between public health and other sectors to really kind of help them fundamentally understand determinants of health, to get the community interested in it and informed, and to actually take them through this process and show them how they can keep doing what they're already doing if they're in a non-health sector, but do it in ways that are going to support health and kind of tie that into some of their larger goals. You know, when we talk about planning, they always talk about health, safety, and welfare as being their objective. So health impact assessment is the way to kind of bring together the policies and the results. And, you know, I'm just kind of really excited to show this one example, which has had some fantastic results. Raise your hand if you have if you're really familiar with health impact assessment or have done one. Okay, so I don't have to go into the basics. Almost everybody's got it. I'll just do it really briefly because there are one or two folks. So it's a systematic process of working together to bring together stakeholder engagement, bring together data, and merge it all into understanding the potential health impacts of something that has been proposed, something that is in a different field and is going to be implemented as a policy or going to get built or something like that, and to make it so that it is actually, to make recommendations and kind of forecast that potential health impact, and then make recommendations to make it better, mitigate any problems, and get them to sort of change course for the best. And it's the process of HIA that's really much more important than the final report or, you know, than the specific recommendations. It's this process together. The first stage is screening, just to decide whether or not to do an HIA. And so our health impact assessment dealt with affordable housing. Specifically, it's the state of Georgia has, every state in the U.S. is responsible for developing a qualified allocation plan, which determines how they're going to issue these housing tax credits. They're federal tax credits that flow through the state. The state of Georgia also matches theirs with some state tax credits. It comes out to about $22 million a year, which is a lot, and funds about 30 affordable housing developments, maybe 2,000 plus units. About 600 of those are reserved for people with some sort of maybe disability or other special need. And so it's, you know, it's a big program. It's working for some of the most vulnerable populations, some of the very lowest income people. It's all reserved for people who are either at 60%, 50%, or 25%. I'm blank. I'm sorry, 30% of area median income. But very vulnerable populations. We know that housing affects health. We know that affordability of housing affects health from a lot of other research out there. And of course, we know that the place that you live has a huge impact on your health, especially for children, but really for everyone across the life course. So there's a lot of justification for doing this. And then one of the most exciting things was the decision maker which was the Georgia Department of Community Affairs, was extremely interested in this. I wish I had their quote up here instead of the dean of our school, but you know, they just said, oh, we've always been thought that it's important to think about the health of people who are living in these properties. We just didn't know how to do it, you know. Thank you for coming along and giving us free consultation. And then, so once we were committed to do it and had everything in place, then the next phase of scoping, which can be really tricky. You want to look at everything. There's a ton of evidence out there. The QAP, I haven't pulled it out. We're actually at a moment right now where the 2016 QAP is out for public comment, and I have to provide some comments on it by the end of the day today. But basically, it's, you know, when you print the whole thing out, it's about that thick. It's got in about 30 competitive scoring criteria. It's got 30 or 40 threshold criteria for what you can submit in the first place. It's got a bunch of other documents appended along with it. So it's a huge policy, huge realm of potential health impacts, and so we had to really narrow down what we were going to research, because otherwise we'd spend, you know, years working on this. And we had a few months to do it. And the whole project itself has taken maybe a year and a half, but what the actual process is that they have listening sessions from July through September in 2014. At this point, we hadn't seen the 2015 draft, but we could look back at the previous year's version and know that it was kind of pretty similar. They don't like to shake things up too much. The developers will get mad. And then we had just a 30-day period to actually see what was in the draft 2015 version and provide those comments. And so it was a pretty tight time frame, and because of this, we kind of did this staged process, I'll come back to that in a second, of doing a rapid assessment for all of this stuff. There is so much known information about health impacts right now. And we kind of live in a golden age of research where things about walkability, which they had elements of pedestrian circulation in this plan, things about who could live in the property, things about, you know, where they can be located. There was so much that we could already say about, yes, proximity to amenities is good for health. Walkability is good for health. So what we actually wound up doing was this rapid assessment, where all of these things that had already been the subject of multiple health impact assessments and had meta-analyses or systematic reviews, we just kind of summarized those as best practices. And those related around affordability, site design, building design, including landscaping, location, sort of the management and operations and the programming. And even though we did this sort of rapid or even desktop assessment version, it had a big impact. They've adopted about just under a third of those recommendations that were in there. And we put in a little bit of sort of statewide data to back it up to justify those things. You know, how many low-income people do walk on a regular basis, for instance. And we also did this deep dive assessment in terms of thinking about two major things: access to quality education, and the thing that we kind of called community connections, thinking about where, if we know that there are so many issues right now with segregation, with different community opportunities based on the socioeconomic and demographic status of the community. We knew there was going to be a lot going on there, and it's potentially more than just building more low-income housing in sort of high-income areas. So we looked more into it as this comprehensive set of how do we create, you know, really fully integrated mixed-income communities. So I'm going to present the next two stages, the assessment and the recommendations, together because they are so merged together. Assessment is sort of a two-tier process where you're looking at the baseline conditions, and then you're also projecting the potential health impacts of the proposed policy. And then the recommendations is, you know, the really fun part where you get to kind of apply the research that says this is what mitigates this. This is the best way to do this differently based on, it all has to be evidence-based. And also characterizing, you know, if there was not strong evidence for a particular recommendation, it wouldn't be one that we would put much weight behind. So again, the rapid assessment, here's a more detailed list of everything that came out in that. We started with a general statement on housing affordability because the cost of housing is just such a critical issue. Not many people realize that over 50% of renters pay more than 30% of their household income for rent. And we have, you know, very clear research that they spend less. If you're spending too much on housing, you spend less for things like healthcare, education, savings, healthy food, and things that will help you live a healthier life. So the first thing we just said was, hey, this is a good program. And then also focused on environmental health and safety, active design and access, healthy living, and generally recommendation to kind of continue using health impact assessment and health in all policies as a way of moving forward. And then our main recommendations, stuff that we did a really extensive literature review, collected some comprehensive data and really kind of put it together in a summary of what was going on and what needed or what could be done to mitigate that was thinking about the connecting to healthy communities. We defined what a community of opportunity was, thinking about in terms of physical amenities and design and conditions, and also thinking about it in terms of it being a place where there are no social barriers because of somebody's, you know, age, income, education, or anything else. And it turned out that the Department of Public Health had already thought about all of these things and created this fantastic sociodemographic index, which they called demographic clusters, using 25 variables related to age, income, family structure, housing value type, educational attainment, employment type, and had mapped them out into 18 different classifications. And so they also had all of the health data related to these clusters, and basically some of them had that were healthier than others. They had very different death rates. They also had very different years of potential life loss, so different rates of premature death. And you can generally see this is going, A1 is sort of the highest sociodemographic status, D7 is sort of the lowest. There's a lot of other variables going on in there. The yellow ones are all rural, for instance, so there are a lot of factors. Some of these are older populations, so they do have a higher rate of mortality just for that factor. But in general, you can see with both of these, there are significant differences in health outcomes, even after you deal with those major factors like urbanity and age. And so we looked at whether the low-income housing tax credit properties were locating, which of those clusters were they located in, because that could potentially have something to do with the health opportunities there. Did it in GIS. It was a lot of work to get all of this data together. I won't go into that. But basically what we found was that nearly all of the tax credit properties, especially nearly all of the family properties, which is where children live, were locating in those really low sociodemographic areas, which also had higher rates of premature mortality. There were some locating in some of the higher income areas, but those were predominantly senior properties. There's a lot of issues around getting communities to accept tax credit properties in their community, and sometimes it's easier to put in a senior property. And so that's what we saw happening there, was that seniors were getting some access to some of those higher opportunity areas, and families with young children generally were not. So we actually did this calculation of, you know, what would be your estimated mortality if all those people were living in, if you have all of the people living in those units, living in these clusters with their current mortality rates, and then what would happen if you actually shifted them so they were living like the rest of the state of Georgia population, if the distribution was kind of shifted so there was more in the A's and the B's and the C's, just like the rest of the population gets to live. And calculated that there would be about 80 lives saved per year if you could do that, of the tax credit property residents. So It's a lot of estimating going on in there, but that was a really powerful number. And we also came up with another number, which was 200 lives per year if you took everybody and put them in those healthiest demographic clusters. And so that 200 longer, healthier lives per year has really kind of become the championing cry of people who participated in this HIA. Because that makes it human. That gives them the story to say, this is why we need to change. You know, we're not just talking about data and statistics and health outcomes. We're talking about people's lives. And so we made some really specific recommendations. We said, you know, this is the way the QAP works, is that they give you some points for doing this and some points for doing that, and fewer points if you do it a little bit. So we specifically gave them the language to use, and that was based around just using the demographic clusters. It seemed like the most obvious way to take that index and integrate it into their planning. We also had a lot of other recommendations around community revitalization and using some of the other stuff that they have in there to make more opportunities to locate in high quality areas or to help revitalize areas. And also some stuff about some recommendations, some things that tied back to that rapid assessment that kind of said, oh, and you should also, you know, make sure that you're creating an inclusive community, some place where people are not in an apartment building behind a fence where they never interact with their neighbors. You should also make sure that people are walking around and going to stores and interacting with their neighbors. And then we also did the educational assessment. This one was a little more straightforward. Again, we had the location of all the properties, and we had the locations of all the schools, and we have this great index that the Georgia Department of Education has created about college and career readiness. And so again, we were able to match them to the nearest school and see, you know, whether they were near high-scoring schools, low-scoring schools. And it turned out that they were predominantly near the lower performing schools and much less likely to be near the higher performing schools relative to the rest of the population. We did also look at early learning, and that's inconclusive right now because Georgia is still kind of developing an index and scoring process for that, and that's supposed to be done in 2017. So we made really specific recommendations about they put in the previous year, they had put in something about locating near high-scoring schools, but they had only used test scores, and it was really hard to use. You had to look up this score and that score and that score and add them together and compare them against this other number, and so we just gave them sort of one number and said if it's over, you know, 75, then they get points, and then they should get more points if all three of the schools that the kids are going to go to are above average, and they took it. So, very briefly, we put in our rapid assessment. We put in some sort of pre-comments on education before the actual draft came out. We submitted official comments on the community connections during the public comment period. And got some great results. It was really exciting. You know, they kind of amped up some of the stuff on green housing. They amped up they put in some things about not locating near busy roads, and then took it back out because the developers, it's actually a major part of the way they pick their locations is to be on busy roads, so that's kind of for future work. Improved things about pedestrian circulation. They put in some services. It turns out all these properties are required to provide services. Usually they do monthly birthday parties or something. And we provided this whole extra set of things that they could do, you know, health education classes, CPR classes, you know, fitness, things like that. And they took that and put that right in there and created a whole extra class of services that can be provided on the properties. And then they updated some of the planning stuff, expanded revitalization, expanded leveraging of public resources. And I'll talk about the stable communities, the demographic clusters, in just a second. And then they also changed the quality education criteria, basically took our wording almost verbatim and put that in. They did try to find a way to ding them for locating near a failing school, But that was also kind of problematic, needs further work, so that did not make it into the final draft, and there was no change for early learning. And but the really interesting thing is that, you know, like I was saying, there we have been talking about health and all policies and how do you do it and how do you get started, and thinking of health impact assessment as the way to get started has put us into this fantastic place now where we're kind of doing health and all policies. This policymaker got the message, they understood how they could use it, without hurting their primary purpose, their primary mission and of their agency. And so now we're getting invited back to participate in a discussion about creating community revitalization. They did put the demographic clusters into the 2016 draft QAP because they had enough time to talk about it with the developers at the listening sessions. And so that's in there, and you know, like I said, those comments are due today, and so we're going to be able to submit comments saying that this is good and you should keep it in there. And you know, it basically took the wording, the language that we had provided them again, and just put it in there as it was. So it was a really good way to provide that recommendation in a way that they could use it. They didn't have to figure out how to do it. And you know, there's really so many more opportunities to go from here. Maybe next year in 2017, that early learnings index will be out and we can get them to put that in. Or maybe we can come back next year and revisit, you know, let's figure out how to get developers on board with not locating residential properties right on top of busy highways or something like that. So it's kind of launched this health and all policies opportunity. And then, you know, thinking also that this is not the only program they have, they also deal with project-based vouchers and they deal with housing choice vouchers and have a lot of influence over all the housing authorities in this state. So, you know, the future is wide open from here in terms of affordable housing and health in Georgia. We're also going to be doing three health impact assessments on specific properties that are proposed in 2015 that get awarded some tax credits, and looking for ways to do further evaluation and assessment. We also did a comprehensive evaluation of this HIA and two others in community development, and so you should go to Jimmy Dill's session right after that, right after this one at 10:30 if you want to learn more about the evaluation. Thank you. And I think we're going to take questions at the end. Great. Thank you.